Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
I mean, first of all, people haven't a clue what I'm doing here, so shall I just introduce myself?
Well, they never do, though. I mean, you don't have to worry about that, because I talk to people, and more and more I'm just talking to people that nobody's heard of, and I don't introduce anybody, and the nature of this podcast is that's a big part of liminalism. It's two people connecting, and it doesn't need to be explained or contextualized, but by all means, if you want to, you can, but... No, I don't think you've listened to very many podcasts.
No, I haven't.
You probably don't have a set. That's all it is. It always starts running, so to speak, and it's just like eavesdropping. I mean, many people have said that. These podcasts are like eavesdropping. So yeah, I almost never have somebody introduce themselves, even if they've got, like a CV or anything. It's just, it's all about the meaning of the conversation itself, that's where the value is, I think.
Well, I'd like to, if there's anybody listening who was on the LLL, Liminal Language Lab, I'd like to just to say hello to them, because I was on there for a couple of months or so. So that was last year. And in a way, it's thanks to that little group we had then, which has led me to going to Europe in the first place. So that's why I'd like to acknowledge, with gratitude, what happened there.
So before we get to Lesbos, if we do, I mean, I think there's a lot there that you could talk about that would interest people in terms of your actual mundane experiences. But before we do, maybe it would be good to zero in on something that has to do with you and I and our different perspectives, because that comes out every time we talk anyway.
Yes.
I think do you remember how once I referred to you as being quite new agey?
Yes, and then you saw after the Garbanzo dance that was not the case.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I did want to somehow communicate that to my listeners, which is they already know I'm definitely not new agey. And yeah, it's true, when I see you in action, it's something else entirely. It's a very visceral, very primal, very warrior-like kind of energy that you express. But when you're describing your experiences and when we're talking about our different interpretations of stuff, they are very different. And I just thought it might be worthwhile kind of focusing on that a little bit in terms of what that is. So when you've been talking now about these different energies within you and without you, and these different clues and prompts and cues and all the rest of it that have been guiding you, one of the sort of skeptical thoughts I had was, well, how much is that a kind of programming that isn't just cosmic? Like, how much could it come down to social programming? And then also when you said about how the hidden hand, whether it's the government or whether it's God, there's no different. Well, of course, I agree with that in a deep sense.
I didn't say it was no different. I said there was no separation between... what I meant was... I mean, there is a difference, because one is connected to... only a certain ceiling. So like the hidden hand, the level of consciousness which is operating on that particular level, it operates from particular limited kind of programmed actions. Which is when you see, for example, things repeated in the news, and you think, oh yes, it's just here we go again. You'll see there's a formula. It's like very, like there's a sort of script. So it's like the people who are tapping into that level, there's a ceiling to that level, and I saw that very clearly in Lesbos when I was looking over. There's a ceiling to that dark level, if you like, because it's not connected to the source energy. So it's not so because it's not connected in that highest way, it doesn't have the power of creativity. So it only operates on very limited levels. But if it was connected to the highest, it would have the power to create and be creative and inspirational. But as it is, it's quite predictable, which is why often they shoot themselves in the foot with really kind of obvious operations.
So here's an example maybe of what you're describing, and this, again, something I don't know from experience, but what I read about, I think it was that book, Elizabeth Hike Initiation, possibly, but anyway, about the Egyptians and how initially, I mean, the highest expression of that culture, when they did seem to be connected to the transmission, the divine energies in a way that was pure, if there ever was such a time, but let's say there was, that the way they used language was all spoken, and that in order to speak a word or to describe a given phenomenon or a given energy, they had to actually tune into it and let it express through them. So the connection between sound, the voice, and language was all one thing. So essentially the essential meaning of that was that you couldn't speak about anything that you weren't embodying in that moment.
Yes, I mean, the thing about the Egyptians was in the early days they were very connected, but as their rituals and their religions and their society went on for thousands of years, the key thing about the Egyptians is they should have moved on, but they had this very rigid way of ritualizing things, which actually created this whole structure in a way which is still in our subconscious now, because it was so imprinted and so done far too long, so it created this structure there. But and then when we became when it moved on to like the Greek consciousness, where form and beauty but then it was much more to do with the intellect, the mind was then becoming more intellectual, then we had philosophy and laws and democracy, that kind of thing.
Right, but also the Olympics. So yeah, they also had that physical.
The physical yeah. And thing. So, yeah. But it kind of grew out of the earlier Egyptian.
Right. Well, so this is where my suspicion and skepticism comes from, is that, and I mean, it seems as though you and I both have some sort of deep resonance with that time and with those energies and with those archetypes and all the rest of it, but without maybe going into that because it's very difficult to talk about. But we also have an awareness of the dark side of it and the abuse of that power, and I think that's what we're zeroing in on, that once something becomes a mind concept and just an interpretation, then that knowledge can be abused, and to some extent those very energies can be abused to some extent.
Well, yes, but we don't actually need to use symbols now, and I think, as you're saying, the use of symbols, people willy-nilly will use symbols or have tattoos with symbols on without understanding that those symbols have power. And they can attract energies in alignment with whatever that symbol is, which can be very it can clutter the works, you know. You can prevent a clear connection, but if we go to the heart, and do whatever we can do to just really strengthen the love energy, that will dissolve just by the just by its very resonance, it will dissolve the lesser energies, either in the field or basically, it comes very simply back to love.
So, like today is Easter, for example, and I'm aware of that, you're aware of it. We even chose that as a day. You text something about Christ, you even mentioned it. I haven't done anything to observe Easter today. I had a weird experience on Friday night, Good Friday night, where I was woken up by a cat screaming like it was being murdered. It was that blood curdling. And I was afraid it was Garbanzo. And I went out and called his name. There wasn't much more I could do. You know, I wasn't going to. Wherever it was, if it was him and whatever cat it was, it wasn't in the garden. You know, it was, wouldn't be any way to find him. So I just had to go back to bed, and I just lay there for quite a time, concerned, obviously, that something terrible might have happened to Garbanzo. And then I remembered it was Good Friday. I thought, oh my God, maybe, you know, somebody's doing ritual sacrifices of cats on Good Friday. And then I thought, oh, you know, maybe I brought it on my head because I didn't honour Good Friday, like I didn't observe it. We even opened our thrift store on Good Friday, which generally most shops are closed because it's a Christian town, blah blah blah. Anyway, it was curious for me to observe that I had this superstitious thing of, oh, you know, maybe I'm going to be punished, or maybe, you know, maybe something bad's going to happen because I didn't put my attention on Christ and the crucifixion, whereas normally I used to always anticipate this weekend, and I often had visions on Good Friday night, things on Sunday, you know, corresponding to the resurrection, because I heavily identified with Christ, and so I would make a big deal out of it one way or another, and less and less do I do that. And this is part of that's been my process, has been to let go of the need for any kind of external acknowledgement or anything, because for me particularly it's always been so much in the head. And I could do a ceremony that would open my heart and then I could have an experience, but even that I've come to distrust, because it's still the mind trying to create an experience for itself, you know. So now it's very much like just hands off, just let life live itself, very mundane working man, and then things they do emerge organically, of their own accord, and then it's a surprise, and then it's more like I'm receiving something rather than that I'm actually generating it myself. I guess that's what it's come down to, is not trusting that I'm not generating these experiences, because I've got so much knowledge and I've got all the keys, even, you know, without going back to past life stuff, but we can allow that unconsciously we've got a lot of the keys, and we know unconsciously how to manipulate energy to create synchronicities, to create experiences, to create these clues and cues, and create the sense that we're living this grand cosmic story, and yet that's not really it, is it? I mean, it isn't.
I don't know who's. I mean, I think it's the humility of. I mean, I don't mean. You said about creating an external thing to do with Easter or whatever. But I'm not referring to external. For me, it's an internal acknowledgement that it's in my innermost sort of essence, if you like. So it's not doing external things or making altars or going to church or anything. It's just a kind of whisper. A gentle whisper inside, and fanning that flame of that whisper, and so that that's what moves. You know, that's what moves. But I agree. Yes, it's when you've had a head stuffed full of knowledge, or esoteric whatevers. It's very, you know, one needs to be very careful not to subtly manipulate any situation, as you just said, whether unconsciously or anything. So for me, it's very much not using any of that. It's just hands off and just have it as my inner reflection. But we're all different, you know, that's my way.
Yeah. So do you see that you're being drawn to Greece? How do you see that the congruence of you being drawn to Greece as part of your archetypal programming, or however you want to call that, and what's happening in Europe and you wanting to go there just to help people?
Well, it was a two-way thing. The first thing was, it was never a head thing. I want to go to Greece to help people. It was just a real calling from the heart that I needed to go. I didn't actually know why or what. So it could be karmic, but I don't want to put labels on it. When I got there, I realised I was a lot older than most of the volunteers, because I'm in my mid-50s and they're mostly in their 20s. I thought, wasn't that sure what usefulness I was going to be. I was there mostly as a, well, I did volunteering, helping people get dressed and helping them with their food and helping with the children. But it was also much more to see what was going on behind the scenes, if you like. Because I was sitting on the beach in Lesbos looking over to Turkey, and I thought, what? And I was just very aware of this kind of, I can only describe it like a thinning or a hole or a, in the same way that the ozone layer is over the earth, it was almost like a thinning of some protective layer or some dimensional hole, if you like. And I was just sort of aware of this hole being like a funnel or a entry point or a gateway for this very low level different consciousness coming through, you know, not very nice, let's say.
Coming through from where?
Well, from another level. I mean, I can't put a name on it. I can't say it was on Route 66. Route 66, Nino, or Highway 81. I can't, just from the intergalactic superhighway, I can't say that. I can just say it was a different interdimensional doorway. But what was very clear was that it was very limited. You know, as I said before, it was there was a ceiling to it. It wasn't really very, it wasn't multidimensional. It was very limited. Mm-hmm. And what was really clear also was the amount of this whole web, really, this whole thing being orchestrated and being manipulated and hidden handed, but at the same time as that being a reality on one level, also that it was supreme genius, absolute master genius. I mean, what sheer genius. If you want people to wake up or to move or crack open their perceived identity, what better way to create something? You know, we're doing it. It's no external thing doing it, that to create a situation where we're having to face our deepest fears, our deepest mistrust of other people, our deepest prejudices, and at the same time having opportunities to really show compassion. I mean, there was incredible compassion. We had students from all over the world there. At the same time, you've got this other, the human condition, so you had both realities existing. And the other thing was to see the difference between what the news put on the put out, which is like you see like a shock horror story, but in reality it's part of the totality. So you've got people fishing, and you've got children playing, and you've got dogs barking, you've got people picking up the milk bottles. So you've got life happening around these traumatic events. So it kind of puts it in a much more less dramatic situation. So you see, actually, it's life happening, and there's no drama to it. It just is. So the drama only happens when it's taken out of its context and put in the papers or on the news, or it's cutting, it's separated from the whole. When you're actually in it, as they say in England, when you're actually in it, it just is. It's just happening. I mean, there were people coming whose families had, been incredible suffering, and the little boy I was playing with on the trampoline, and I said, my heart was just, I wanted to hug him. He was 12, and he had, his little glasses were on, and he had some smudges on his, on the glass, and his, the right part of his glasses was stuck up with sellotape. And he had little rosy cheeks and a dimple, and he was waiting so patiently for his go on the trampoline. And I said, "What's your name?" And he said, "Hussein." And I said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "Aleppo." And I thought, shit, his house has probably just been completely demolished, bombed to smithereens, and he's just standing here with me, patiently waiting for the go on the trampoline. It just seems so, I don't know, bizarre. And then there's this other little boy, he must have been about 4, and they had the slide, and they were having a go on the slide, and I was helping him down. And when little kids, they have an experience they want to share, and they just want to get it out. They go, da, 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 da. They just bundle it all out. And this little chap, he had so much to tell me, and I couldn't obviously understand a word he was saying, but he was like putting his face up to me and letting it all come out, and da, 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 da. And he was doing these movements with his hands, which kind of looked like being on a boat, and it looked like pretty rough treatment, and he was trying to tell me. And then he'd go on the slide, and then at the top he'd stop and look at me and start his little story again. Then he'd go down the slide, and then he'd stop at the bottom and kind of reflect, as though he was like processing something, and he'd get up, his little legs would get up, and he'd go round again for another go. But it was just pouring out of him his story, which I have no idea what it was about. But it's just all these kids with, this trauma, and mothers. Yet it was also very normal. Even saying that, it sounds dramatic, but it wasn't dramatic. It just was.
And for you either, it wasn't a dramatic experience going there and seeing all that?
No. Well, it was humbling, but because there were so many volunteers out there, loads and loads of volunteers and loads of press, and it was like a circus. It was quite revolting as well, with the kind of, I don't know, it had quite a revolting side, with all the press and wanting stories and people doing selfies and that kind of side of it. But it was also incredibly heartening to see this light, this compassion, this love coming through for complete strangers, and meeting, making eye contact with the the Syrians and the Afghanistans, and as they queued up, and you could make eye contact with them, so you were seeing beyond the setting. And there was actually the main bit which touched me really was I met this group of Muslim British charity people, and they were driving this van around and giving out food at the harbour, and that's our first day there, and they gave us a lift, and we helped them. And there was this young woman, and she was dressed from head to foot, but our eyes met, and it was like a real and she must have been about 20 or something, I should think, but it was like two souls. In that moment, our eyes met, and there was a complete jing, 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 like a connection on a soul level. And it was almost like, ha, 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 what the fuck are we doing? It was just somehow, it was just this thing beyond the appearances, and there was this real exchange. That was, I think, out of all of it, that was my main thing, this exchange on a soul level with this Syrian woman. Giving her some milk, and she looked at me across the thing, and it was just like this, yeah, what are we doing? What is it? You know, we know this isn't it. We know there's something more than this. It was yeah.
So what kind of reception or response did you get from people in England about doing this, and when you got back, were people supportive, or were they curious, or how did people see it?
Mostly they were supportive. A couple of people on Facebook questioned, you know, why was I helping, and they brought in, of course, you know, the rapes and the negative side, the women being raped and things like that, which had happened obviously earlier on in the year after Cologne. So I think there's a lot of naivety happening, at least there was, because there's two, like, there's the people who are going there to help, but there's a lot of people who are doing it as, I know, like socialist sort of everybody welcome, we're all one, blah blah blah, don't talk rubbish, we can, you know, let everybody in, it's all one big happy family.
Right.
There's that side, and then you've got the other polarity, which is nobody come in, blah blah. And so you've got this massive polarity happening in, you know, right across Europe, or happening globally, where you're seeing this, the middle way is not really being addressed. You've got,
yeah,
and you know, I think the middle way needs to be addressed, because it's preposterous to think, like the, like some of the young girls, not girls, they were students, like they were welcoming some of the people in the way with, you know, students here, you'd hug each other and very open. But I thought, and they were still doing that to some of these young guys coming over. I thought, hang on, their partners, their wives are covered from head to toe for their, you know, their modesty. And then they're getting greeted by us or these young Western girls in this way. And it must be incredibly perplexing, you know, muddling for
them. Yeah.
And there was a couple of students, I thought, hang on, just, you know, just be a bit more clocked on about this. So there's that side of it, of not really understanding the depth of some of the differences on, you know, in, culturally, you know. Sorry, am I saying you know a lot? How infuriating, sorry. God. Just tell me to stop saying you know. She's coming.
junk plow burn.
About liminality?
Well, yes.
Because you're talking about it, is the reason I ask.
It's the space in between.
Right, the space in between, so between different states. So, like, a gypsy is a liminal being because they're constantly going from one place to another. A teenager is a liminal being because they're not a child anymore, but they're not an adult yet. And so on, and of course Syrians and the refugees, that's total liminality. They're actually, their old way of living is over, and they haven't found a new way of living. They might be permanently liminal. But then there's of course the psychological state of liminality, where we beliefs that we've held for our whole lives are no longer holding up, and we can't formulate new beliefs, and that I would say is, when you were talking before about the opportunity of all this, I would say that's very central to understanding the opportunity of liminality, is you have to let go of old structures without waiting for new ones to come into being, or without depending on that, or without prematurely creating them. You have to be able to exist in a state without structure, without meaning, without mental meaning, without understanding even, but the thing is, people don't, because the constructed identity can't exist without structure, because it is structure and it imposes structure on everything, the mind, and so then you get one of the side effects or products of liminality is called bipolarization. So what you're describing is there's no middle ground, because that is the liminal space. So when it's becoming more and more liminal, it feels less and less safe. Like if you've got more or less reliable structures and reliable institutions, and you feel safe, then you can entertain different possibilities, you can question. But the more and more threatened the stability and the structures of the institutions and beliefs become, the less people are able to be liminal, the less they're able to say, well, it could be this way, it could be that way. Like, you get extremism. And so you could use transgender as another example. Just about anything nowadays, there's no middle area. Either you're virulently against it and you side with fascists or neo-Nazis or fundamental Christians, or name your, you know, extremist right kind of group, or you end up in this crazy made neoliberal thing where there are no facts, it's all just feelings, and it kind of everything goes, really, although I mean potentially.
I mean, it's like a plunger, you know, when you have a plunger, when you've got a dirty drain and you go down onto,
yeah,
it feels like, yeah, that, like it's coming down, but only the plunger is like this, is like light, if you like a shaft of light, and it's plunging down, it's descending, and it's as it plunges down, the waves are parted, or like the polarities are more extremely seen.
Right.
So the polarities are completely in our faces now, whereas everything from this plunger of light, it's the whole deepest subconscious has now come up, everything on every single level. It's, as you said, it's whether it's transgender, whether it's race, whether it's chemtrails, whether it's whatever, it's on every single level it's now coming up. So the middle way, there isn't, the whole lot's got to go until the we just got to let it go. And it actually, coming back, I actually felt like this grief. I think I told you, I listened to, when I was in Greece, I was kept singing to myself, even though I didn't know the song. So I sing song myself. I sung myself the title of the song, because I remember the LP cover when I was young, of George Harrison's All Things Must Pass. And it was like this, you know, I could feel myself, my dying, you know, I could feel everything dying. I could feel me, this identity dying. And I had to kind of mourn it. And it was also the hope coming with that, because it was seeing these young people who were the students or the people in their 20s who had achieved so much organization and new ways of implementing how things were happening, you know, with their getting the camp up and running and this, that and the other. And it was like my generation, okay, you've done, this is now time to hand over the baton to the next generation, and they are doing it differently, but the baton has been handed over in a way. That's how it felt. But we're not there yet. Yeah, well, it's got a long way to go, but the whole lot's got to crumble. It's like you cannot put new wine into old skins.
Well, I'm curious about that generational thing, because, I know you've said it a few different times, different ways. There was something a little bit wistful about it, I felt, in that your feeling of being... of the passing generation, so becoming obsolete, so to speak, but I'm also getting older and weaker and less able to actually carry the burdens of or responsibilities. Or I'm not entirely sure how you meant it. That's why leading to my question, really. So, I mean, how much of that is? It seems as though two things are getting conflated, was the sense I got. Was one is your experience as an individual, as a woman who's growing older, and the feeling of, I mean, I'm certainly having that, my God, just the reality of that, and the having to let go of illusions and dreams and all the rest of it that just comes inevitably with aging, on the one hand, but then also you have this... it seems like a very optimistic or hopeful view about the younger generations coming in and, as you were just saying, picking up the baton. I don't have that. That's why I want to ask you about it. I have the first thing. I absolutely have the wistful sense of growing old and running out of time and becoming less able to do the things I want to do. But I don't have the sense of, yay, the young are coming and they're going to... pick up the baton. And...
Well, I hadn't really thought of it, and I've got sons 24, 23, and 18. But I was genuinely encouraged by how they'd got things going, you know, like in the Calais jungle, for example. But, you know, I think that's been pulled apart at the moment. But this whole thing is being organised, for better or for worse, through the generation which uses Facebook and mobile phones and ding, 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 ding. You know, they're there in the cafes, da-da-da-da-da, on their little gizmos and, you know, me and my cranky buttons. It's totally different. You know, they're using this, the technology. It's, and this is what's so spooky, well, not spooky, but interesting, is this situation in Europe wouldn't have happened in the way it has without Facebook, basically.
Would you say these young people, with their social networks and all the rest of it, are firmly on the neoliberal side, who are completely unquestioning of letting...
I mean, I was surprised how... A lot of them were atheists, a lot of them were idealists, and a lot of them were sort of, you know, no borders. Not exactly anarchists, but no borders brigade. So they were kind of coming at it from, you know, authority is bad and what we're doing is good, and idealists, I suppose.
Would you be able to have a conversation with them about deeper stuff? I don't mean spiritual, but deeper,
well,
sort of social questions. Like...
Well, it's quite interesting. Yes and no. I mean, some of them were, you could do. There's one woman, she was my age, and she was a Parisian circus performer. and she was like very creative, and that was her world. She ran a business operating circuses, and she said this has really, really challenged her, what's happening in Europe, because she's always thought of herself as a feminist, and she's fought for women's rights, and she's been politically right on, etc., etc. And suddenly, after the Paris attacks, she's finding herself feeling fearful and resentful of, like, you know, having to tell her daughter to be careful at night, etc., etc., etc. And she said she doesn't want to have these fears in her head. I said, well, this is fantastic, showing us, is showing what's there, you know, it's what everybody's got in the subconscious, and this is a brilliant thing that this is all coming out now. We can actually see all our gunk and all our prejudices. But she was finding it really shocking that she had such thoughts. I thought, God, you know, you're shocked that you've got foul thoughts. But yes,
I don't know, even that though. I mean, that she even thought that they were foul thoughts, to be afraid for her daughter's safety when women are being raped by refugees. I mean, it is a reality, even if it's over, you know, even if it's being orchestrated, and even if it's been exaggerated. And
yes,
as far as she knows, it's a reality. So the fact that she considered it foul thoughts at all, it says a lot, doesn't it?
Well, I think she was shocked that she was feeling more she was feeling more right wing, I suppose.
the horror.
She thought she was going to be, you know, open borders, let everybody in, but she realised she wasn't feeling that. So it's fascinating. I think on every level, people are having to face themselves.
Yeah, well, that's back to that liminality, and those, and I think it is very few, and so this is where I am sceptical about the promise of the young, but those people
Trump's.
Who are, well, the baton carriers, and I mean, because Occupy Wall Street was, that seemed, well, not to me, to be honest, but my wife was into it, seemed like that was really good, and they're all organised and they're doing stuff, but I don't really think, I mean, to some extent, absolutely, if people are engaging in the world and getting out there and meeting other people, then it's a way of engaging with the material reality, and it can be an individuation process, and an awakening process, absolutely, but then that would include joining the Ku Klux Klan, potentially, you know, as long as you come through the other side of it. Yeah, rather than
just
believe.
You to jump over Ku Klux clan. It's a wide.
Well, it's because ideology. I mean, what? And this is interesting. I wanted to zero on earlier as well, because the bipolarization is getting more extreme, as I'm sure you've experienced. And it's we can see it now, although I don't pay attention. But with the Trump, what's going on around
He's
Donald Trump?
fantastic, isn't he?
Is well the neoliberals who absolutely obviously hate Trump and hate anyone who supports him are becoming so violent that they're actually physically attacking Trumpites, and so they're acting exactly the way that they despise Trumpites for being, right? So that bipolarization, that as the extremes become further and further apart, eventually they meet and they become one thing. That seems to be what's happening.
I mean, if you know Jason and the Argonauts, you know when they're on Mount Olympus and they're looking into the pool, and then they're moving
The gods,
the gods, and they're seeing in the pool and they're seeing what Jason's up to and stuff. Well, if they were to look at what's happening now and they thought, aha, let's really create something to. Yes, not put a cat amongst the pigeon. So they get their clay, and they get their earthly clay, and they put their little hands into the water, and they mix and match, and then they mold this thing. And then what they do, they would make Donald Trump, and they'd make Donald Trump. They say, okay, what are we going to have? Okay, he's going to be bombastic. He's going to be arrogant. He's going to all the attributes which the people of, lots of people are thinking in America, but they don't dare express. We're going to mix him all up. We're going to put him in this
like the id.
this doll called Trump. We're going to put a funny hairdo on him, and we're going to plonk him down there, and we're going to put him to run for president. I mean, it's just sheer genius, isn't it? Every ridiculous thought, all the prejudices, all the
So that's but that's like the gods creating monsters of the id, and so the gods are our unconscious, like the collective unconscious, giving form to that thing that we're
So now we've
not
got the god of
able
Trump.
to.
He can join the pantheon, but he can be. I mean, my mother, she said, my mother says strange things. She said, "Oh, well, they assassinate people, don't they? They can assassinate presidents, so hopefully he'll be assassinated." I said, "Mum,
Who was she thinking was this
who they?
benevolent they?"
I don't know. I mean, she's 92. I think because she remembers the war, and I think she finds it quite worrying, actually, to even consider that Trump's.
Well, I'm quite pristine, psychically virgin with Trump, because I don't really even know what he looks like, and I've never seen him, I've never heard him. I'm just picking it up all second hand, and I'm agreeing because I know that's how it works, right? So, and I also, appreciate it when the really negative qualities become more visible. I always think that's a good sign. But my point about the Ku Klux Klan was that ideology, any ideology, it doesn't matter what the ideals are, once it becomes fixed and taken to an extreme, then it becomes, quote, fascistic, unquote, as in it becomes violent. Because if you fiercely believe in whatever it is and the resistance makes stronger, then eventually, you believe you have to fight and kill to protect what you believe in. There seems to be, I mean, I
Well,
just.
it's the laws of duality, isn't it? I mean, this whole thing is the breakup of the lie of duality. And whether it's in our thinking, whether it's in our, well, the thinking will have created the institutions, but right the way through duality, it's the illusion, and that's going to be challenged until we are no longer viewing life through the eyes of duality. And then we'll be able to laugh our socks off at all the kerfuffle we made about something which didn't actually have any truth to it to start with.
So, but do you think it's maybe it's just like the experience you had there in Lesbos with that woman in the midst of it all? Maybe it's just having that connection and that awareness in the midst of it. Maybe the social structures, one way or another, it's always going to be dualistic in terms of the physical material universe, isn't it?
I mean, yes, there's always going to be
Man and woman, well, unless they accomplish their goals, of course. But.
Yes, there will always be polarity, but we don't need to. We're back to that middle, the infinity symbol with the middle, the neutral point in the middle. We can come from awareness itself, and which can, if we respond from awareness rather than the mind in duality, then we will meet each other in that, in the heart and in the as awareness or as being, rather than through ideals and projections and thinking and blah.
And it would be impossible for the world to not to transform, of course, if we were meeting in that space. There wouldn't. It's just impossible to imagine what sort of world it would be. So I guess I don't even try. And I think the people who do try tend to get quite busy.
Well, I don't
terrible things.
I don't think it's something. If anybody is trying, then it's missing it because it's.
I think they are trying. I mean, I think the social engineers that are manipulating everything, I think that's what they believe they're doing, is trying to create the perfect world for everything. And so they want to eradicate gender, for example. Oh, let's have a non-dual world in which, you know, post-gender, there's no sexes anymore. Then everyone, you know, no races, no sexes, just blur everything out completely, have a great hive mind, and then there'll be no duality. Be no humanity either, of course. Be no consciousness even.
But behind the push to do that, the thinking to do that, is the greater awareness or being, which is knowing that there's a push for breaking through duality. So it's the actual impulse. Is coming through, working through those people, and they're doing it in a distorted way.
Yeah, literalizing it.
But the actual impulse is one of moving beyond separation. You know,
yeah.
So while all the gender issues are still in our psyche, or in, you know, working themselves out, it's going to come out as distortion. This is what's happening because it's not connected to a deeper knowing.
Right, but it seems as though, that as soon as the problem begins when the inspiration becomes an impulse, because if we, like, the part of us that, any part that's driving us to transcend duality isn't it, because the part that we want to move us already is above, you know, beyond duality. It's non-dual, right? So it doesn't have to change anything.
No, but it can be it hasn't got to change it, but just by seeing it from as awareness itself, the sheer glancing of the duality within us is enough to transform it. So you don't actually do anything. You just need to notice it, and that by noticing it, it comes back to the heart, it comes back into alignment by seeing it, by, because the power of awareness, when it's put into that place, it just goes whoosh. And so that's the key, to keep seated as awareness from the heart, and then whatever arises by glancing at it, it will come back into alignment. And that which isn't, you haven't got to get sucked into it.
Yeah, well, I think it's very hard to do that at any time, or to let that happen at any time. But to when one's focused on the world, it becomes almost impossible. And I mean,
Well, that's where the discernment and choice comes in. I mean, like, if, for example, I like to look at the Daily Mail online, nice crappy newspaper, for example, and I do that out of entertainment, but I'm not letting myself get sucked into the story or the believing the storyline. I'm seeing it as a relative. I'm seeing it as relative, or so you can see things, the finite story, but anything finite made with finite choices is going to create more of that level. But seeing it for what it is, you'll see what I mean. But don't give it energy.
You do find some of it quite appalling, though, I
Well,
think.
I do. I get, I will indulge my rages.
I think it's okay to have a response to it. I think it's
I'm not
it's that
saying,
middle way again.
but all I'm saying is, it's the choice, is having the choice. Yes, I'm going to have a spat about whatever, vent my spleen about my latest whatever, and but I don't need to get completely sucked into it.
Your tears are golden light upon my hand. You sang the heavens floated on the sea. When beauty reared its ugly head, when every raindrop's misery. Under heaven, the thunder rolls. Its messages in shadows hid. Don't waste away. Messages in shadows here. Don't waste away your wind. You were only born to follow. We poured our blood into the field and left with nothing but the air. We could not eat your promises starve to death while no one cares. And in your voice I disappear. And I am hell like blood. This is the place where Jesus fell, and you're only born to follow. Arise, arise, your work is done. The fields are buried with the dead. How sweet it looks like no one won. Some dreams awaken, some dreams are dead. Thunder rolls. His messages in shadows hid. Don't waste away your wind. You were only born to follow.
Well, this is, I mean, this is, as I think you know, my challenge as a writer, somebody who's writing all the time, is because I'm constantly exploring this and researching it and finding things that are potentially stimulating in a mental way, and it can cause emotional reactions and make my life feel exciting and all of that thing that sucks one in, and the way that I try and counteract that is by always bringing it back to my own internal process. Like, oh, well, why am I drawn to that? And understanding why I'm actually drawn to this material in the first place, that it's providing clues to, you know, the programming or the patterning in my own psyche that led me there in the first place, and then those patterns seem to get dissolved. And so I think there is a lessening of interest actually in the world, but not a lessening of engagement. And again, this seems to be part of growing old. I mean, I think it doesn't always happen just because you grow old, and it's not just about growing old either, but there is something about a gentling of one's awareness with age. And also, I mean, I think a lot of the reason that we get fascinated and hooked by the world is because it distracts us, of course, needless to say. And the main thing we want distracting from, of course, is our mortality. And so for me, when you're talking about awareness, just letting the awareness be there, I can't really paraphrase how you said it, but there is a part of us, and you touched on this very early on about that flame that won't be extinguished, there's a part of us that is non-dual, that isn't affected by any of this. Well, that's the part that I more and more want to tune into as I'm aware of my aging, because the reality of my death to the mind that is dualistic is completely unacceptable, incomprehensible, actually. I mean, it's like I'm haunted by it, I'm plagued by it, by the awareness of my death. And so I keep my awareness there because I know there is a part of me that can reconcile that reality, you know, that we are aware of, you know, dying, and yet we can be okay with that. We can actually live with that awareness in a completely accepting and peaceful way. I know that's possible, but the mind, yeah, the mind has to relinquish its control once the awareness is on death, because the mind doesn't have an answer. At least not one that I want to sell myself. Like, oh, I'll reincarnate, it'll be better next time, or something like that. You know?
Yeah, well, I think when... I mean, death's a... Well, death... It's a strange business.
Yeah.
But I think when I went, saw the Acropolis, and I saw the temple in Dendera and went there, it was absolutely unquestionable that that which I was walking into or meeting as myself had always been there. So to my mind, that was like, oh, quite depressing. I found that quite, oh, God. It's like, oh, Jesus, I've never left. I've been here for eons. I've been here and I'm unchanged. I'm still here. I'm always going to be here. And it was like this really completely knowing that. But to my mind, it was, oh, God.
Yeah, that's the prisoner of infinity.
It's, so yeah, so it's like the mortal part and the true part. But this eight, and just knowing the how time has moved, but that is just never, you know, it's always constant, yet it's moving, but it's not moving. It's just ever present, still present. Yeah.
So that, I mean, that the eternal. The awareness of the eternal can't lead to a doing. I mean, there's nothing for the eternal to do.
No, it just is.
Yeah.
But, right, nothing to say either. So, I mean, that was a really funny thing. When the mind dropped away, I mean, it's come back, as you can see now. It dropped away after a transmission thingy, and I was sitting there, and the mind was completely gone, and history had gone, so there was absolutely no way I could put my or bring up my history or my memory or anything. It had just completely, the slate had been wiped clean.
Were you trying to?
No, it just happened. It was after an online class, and I just found myself just sitting there, and the mind had just gone. And
so there was no language. I mean, can you describe a bit more about this?
Well, it was just completely still, so there was no thoughts coming across the screen of the mind. It was just completely clear. Like
no images, no words, no nothing.
No, and I was just being pulled in deeper and deeper.
But you were aware of it.
Oh yeah, very, so. Very, very aware. Yes, very. You know, I wasn't sleepy. I was just very aware, and so there was complete clarity. So a tree, desk, everything. It was what it was, without any naming or projections onto it or analysis. Or a tree was a tree, a chair was a chair, my room was a room.
And you, what about
and
you?
And I was just was. I just...
You weren't not a Venetia anymore.
Well, I just wasn't thinking about that. I just was. It was just, but then I could see the mind creeping up again. It was like coming from behind. Or round my legs, it seemed to be coming up, and what it was saying was, if I let go, I won't have anything to talk about. And it was like, quick, scrap. It was like pulling on socks, you know. Come back, come back. Otherwise, there's nothing. I won't have any friends because I won't have anything to talk about. And it was, it was a social thing. I thought, no, you know, there'd be no reason to pick up the phone for a chat. There'd be nobody to talk about. And so it was like I sucked it all back again. So that's a bit depressing. That's a bit depressing, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, there's quite a few ways to go with that. One of them is childhood. You know, I like to go there. But like when we first develop an identity in a language, that's socialization. We want to talk to people. You know? So we might feel like we don't exist. Well, the environment that we grow up in might make us feel that we don't exist because adults aren't able to tune into us until we learn language. Right? So how language and the identity first takes a hold of us as a survival thing, like we associate survival with actually being able to think and speak. That's one thing that occurs to me there that I think may be true. The other is, I think, that Dave touches on, I know he does from time to time, is the mind as somehow, in some very weird way, something outside of us that infiltrates us, which is how you described it seemed kind of like that, like it was crawling up your legs.
Yes, it kind of, it came in from the distance. It started to creep back in.
So what do you think about bringing it back to whether it makes it in the podcast, but when initially we're talking about ancestors, the idea that the constructed identity or the false self might have a kind of ancestral, like it might even get installed in us ancestrally, externally.
Yes, I'm big on ancestors at the moment. I'm listening to several, there's a tele podcast thing, free one, and there's different people talking about ancestors. But the ancestral lineages, yes, apparently they completely flow through to those who are at the end of the line, and why they will also be like dropping whispers and hints because they want to have to be helped. So us at the end of the line are those who can actually help with the restoration. But it's a case of discerning which are the good ones and which are the bad ones. Because it's if you think everything is wanting to raise itself up, you know, everything in creation, everything is wanting to move up to the next level. So the ancestral line as well is wanting to raise itself up to the next level.
Well, maybe as a whole, but what about those fragments that just want to perpetuate their survival as fragments and carry on eating chocolate or doing heroin or getting blowjobs or whatever it is that they got addicted to?
Well, they can only feed those addictions if the person at the end of the line is indulging them. So why it's, as I said before, about the idea of discernment and being quite clear with or conscious about why we're doing something when we're doing it, and whether it's actually feeding us, nourishing us, or whether it's actually feeding the parts which are detrimental. So say you've got an ancestor who's got naughty habits and you know that those habits make you feel shitty, just by being aware of that, you'll know whether what you're doing is actually being prompted by the shitty ancestor or whether it's, you know.
Right, so this is very close to the kind of mind-body struggle that everybody has, as in, my mind wants ice cream, but does my body? Well, probably not. Right? So being more in tune with what the body's actually asking for, rather than overriding it with our thoughts. I mean, everybody has a sense of that. I suppose maybe not everybody, but it's a fairly common experience. So, and I do have dietary things I would consider and peccadillas and what have you, but I would certainly say it's a lot more subtle than that as well in terms of actual thought patterns, being addicted to actual patterns of thought.
Definitely. They can definitely be ancestral.
Yeah. And any really, I mean, I notice this more and more actually when I'm going to sleep, when the mind, of course, is getting ready to shut down or at least move into a different, functioning, how I look forward to certain thoughts. I'm lie there thinking, ooh, I could think about this now. Ooh, I can think about that now. And of course, they're just thoughts. Generally, they'll be thoughts that make me feel good about myself as a constructed identity self, like me, this life, this guy who's taking credit for this life kind of thoughts. Ooh, I did a good podcast, or ooh, whatever it
Me,
is.
me, me.
Yeah, just reinforcing that thing. So, I mean, that isn't that the most insidious ancestral program, which is somehow that, well, I guess we have it in our culture, and particularly my family line, which is you must be a somebody.
But everybody's got their own scripts, yes, but it's you don't need to kind of feed them. Once you know they're a script, there's the choice whether to feed them or not.
Yeah, as opposed to just observing them. Although I remember Dave saying to me once that what I do with writing is like giving sugar to the yeast so I can study it better. And he said that was fine. And I was glad he said that because I'm like, well, yeah, that is what I do. So yeah, sometimes if the only thing that changes these patterns is seeing them, then feeding them can be a part of that. As I'm saying that, I'm aware it could sound like a rationalization, but I think it's also true that because we feed them anyway, right? So,
There's a difference, I think, between seeing them with the mind or seeing them with awareness. Because one, the mind will just potentize that mental energy to strengthen that thought form or that groove or that, that neural pathway, whereas facing it with awareness and kind of absorbing it back into itself, that's what will change it, like if you see it and then love it back home, and almost that will have a different effect than just seeing it and potentizing it. And I'm only talking because I've had such crappy, huge grooves of thinking, so I'm not talking from somebody who's all high and mighty. I'm saying because I know what it's like to have really deep mental grooves of negative thinking.
So, can you, how would you describe that process of the opposite of deepening those neural pathways so that you're smoothing out pathways and patterns? And is it like creating more spaciousness in the body? Is that partly how you experience that?
Well, I sort of see it like sand, that if you make drawings in the sand, and it might take quite a long while for the drawings to be washed away by the waves. It can't necessarily be done in one fell swoop, but they gradually become have less hold or less potency by just being kind to them, really. I think there's so much in the spiritual teaching things about rejecting your ego, rejecting these parts of yourself, or mustn't think this, and it just becomes a battleground. And I fought with myself for bloody years. And it was only when I gave up fighting it and just actually tenderly seeing it, and then seeing that whatever it was usually based on some painful, hurt part, which just needed that, to be loved home, really. So I would say the only really is compassion to one's parts rather than rejection.
And how do you, experience it though? I mean, as that's happening, how do you experience it? Is it a physical change or?
Well, say an old groove comes up,
Yeah.
see it, and then what I do is feel it. It has, for me, I have to feel it in the body. So feel.
Oh, okay. So it's a sensation.
So see it, notice the script, feel it, and then really feel it, go into it completely, and then that probably I might cry or I might feel angry, but usually under anger there's grief. And then really go into the heart, really put it into the heart and feel to the depths of the heart that part.
So is that emotional, that going into the heart, or is that also sensory?
Not emotion as in, oh, emotion, but more a kind of honouring of that wound and a deep, almost like a bowing down to it for its being there and making it into, who it's done its part. It's been there and it's been in the dark. It's been shut away like a wounded pet in a dark cage or something. So it's been taken out of the cage. And it's now being seen, and it's probably just feeling very tender, and it's just a lot of grief there. So feel it, and just be very, very tender. And then that gradually each one will come out, and they're integrated by loving them home, really. I think that's the only thing, really. I think love, as usual, is the only thing which is going to do it.
So this, it seems, listening to you, it seems like the ancestors is a similar, I mean the same, even that recognizing, that it begins by recognizing that those parts of us that we thought were us are not us, they're ancestral, and it ends by recognizing that they are us because they're ancestral. So that, first of all, the discerning and separating, and then the accepting and embracing and integrating.
I mean, yes. I mean, there's so many levels to us as humans, aren't there? So there's the deep us, which is the unchangeable bit we talked about earlier, and then there's the layers, which could be on the emotional level, on the psychological level, on the physical level, on the energetic level, etc. And then there's the ancestral energy coming through. So you've got the pain of the ancestors flowing through as well. But I know some people just talk about the ancestral influences and not the karmic influences. For me, they are
Different.
they're intertwined, because why would somebody be drawn energetically to a particular family with a particular ancestral signature? There has to be a resonance of energy to come into that particular family anyway. So they're both help. It's a two-way thing, really. So you can get just deal with it in the here and now, what comes up, and it'll gradually go back like a hose pipe. I imagine it like a blocked hose pipe, clear the bit which is coming out at the end, and the next bit comes down, and then, and that's just an idea which is coming to my head now. But I suppose it doesn't really matter which part it is. The part that matters is how is it affecting us in the here and now, and are we able to feel the happiness or joy or peace or whatnot, and are we moving away from that, or are we moving, doing things which nourish us? I think it can be very simple, really. Well, does that make sense? Sorry, I was rambling a bit.
Do you remember when I asked Dave, it was one of the retreats that we were both on, I'm pretty sure, and he was going into a lot of esoteric stuff, and I was almost complaining about it because it was all the stuff I'd been letting go of, and now he was...
I've never heard him talk in that way.
Teaching people, yeah, I'm pretty sure you're on that one, but anyway, you'll be able to say if you remember this. And so he was talking about souls incarnating and all that, and I asked him, is it possible for a soul to incarnate in more than one body at the same time? And he said, yes, and then he changed the subject. Do you remember that?
I remember the theme, but I don't remember him saying that, no. But I remember that theme. I mean...
So, yeah, go ahead.
No, go on, sorry, go on.
Well, I was going to say, I mean... You and I, and with a little input from Dave, have confirmed, so far as such thing can ever be confirmed, to my own satisfaction anyway, that happened with me and my cat, some mysterious manner.
If they didn't think you're mad, they're going to think you're mad.
I don't think I have mentioned it yet on the podcast. But anyway, but I also think, I mean, I have begun to believe over the last few years, I don't know how long, that it can also happen with human beings, and that sometimes we might meet our own fragments in human form, and they can be really, really annoying, perhaps, like a neighbour that torments us or something. You know, it could be this fragment that's trying to get reintegrated, and because it can't physically be reintegrated, but we need to, it's about karmic, it's an aspect of our psyche that got fragmented off, and that we need, therefore it has to come to us from the outside because we've disowned it, and that's the only way. And it, again, when we're talking about these things, the, you know, the literal and the metaphoric, it gets all blurred, but this basic experience that I've had many times, which is seemingly random individuals who seem to be very kind of intimately tied into my own psychic processes, and so they're karmic in a sense, but not necessarily relating. Well, I guess it is relating to past life, but not necessarily in terms of something that I've done, but something in me that I've actually fragmented off and disowned, and then that has to come from the outside. I think we have touched on this. It's a very deep subject, but how this might relate to the whole of human culture, that it's all come down to fragmentation and... So like all these, you know, I'm very interested in MK Ultra and the way in which our modern culture may have been engineered through programs like MK Ultra and trauma, you know, directed trauma, but it may also be that goes back all the way to Greece and Egypt, and that the gods themselves are fragments of our psyches. Anyway, that's kind of a big, it wasn't really a question, but I'm just throwing it out there if you have any thoughts.
Well, Barry Long writes in his book, Man and the Origins of the Man and the Origins of the Universe, he talks about the how the Greek gods were real people, real, but at that time their consciousness was very plastic, you know. And so they could create form, because consciousness and form isn't separate. So they could create with their will and their minds instantaneous forms. But as they evolved, they became more kind of into the power of it. So they would create these objects out of the plasma, and then they'd have like sexual creatures and things. And gradually, that was like the beginning of this distortion which was starting on the planet, and where a lot of the myths apparently stemmed from were these kind of strange beasts and things, because these so-called gods had actually used their powers to create these things for their own gratification, for their own pleasures.
Well, it's kind of a myth in itself, isn't it? That narrative.
Yeah, I suppose so. But it's interesting because Barry Long was enlightened teacher. He died in 2003, and he had profound insights.
He was a tantric teacher, yeah, who claimed to be enlightened. Did you spend time with
No,
him?
no, no, he was dead in 2003. No, 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 no.
So where did he get that information then?
I think he was able to look into it.
See, this is where my skepticism meets your gullibility, right? Because I don't believe anyone who says they're enlightened. I mean, I don't believe it just because they say it. I think chances are if they say it, they're not.
Well, I don't think you did. I'm saying that.
Oh, you're saying that.
Well, I mean, he was recognised as...
But also, I mean, it's just so much of this seems to be manipulated. I mean, so many of these public figures seem to have actually been placed there in order to manipulate the culture and manipulate individuals and create these honeypots to lure us into them and create these false narratives. And so, I really...
So you think I'm gullible, I know, but I'm not. I don't think I am.
Well, you wouldn't, though, would you? I mean, I know I'm sceptical, or I'm distrustful, or whatever word you want to put on that was...
It's true, I think the best of people until they prove otherwise, yes.
Right. Well, because that's karmic and astrological and all the rest of it, because that's absolutely in my chart, that I distrust, and I think the worst of people in a sense, but not on a one-to-one. I don't, when I meet people, I really do. I'm generally very open to people and think the best of them until they show me otherwise. But I think that is different when you actually meet somebody. I think it's very important to be open. But perhaps it has to do with just how much information I take in that I've just had. And also how impressionable I am, you know, that...
You are with all that Piscean stuff.
Yeah, I used to take things to heart, which is similar to saying that you turn them into items of belief, really. I would just read something and I'd be so impressed by it that I'd just take it on wholesale, like Whitley, of course.
I think more gullible than I am, I think.
Well, I'm more impressionable. Yeah. It's not the same, right? But it's similar, yeah. Definitely. Well, I don't know about more. I mean, but yeah, I would say so. Yeah, no, you don't seem to be that impressionable, but just, I mean, perhaps to you it really isn't gullibility. Perhaps, for all I know that Barry Long, whatever it is that you're saying, for all I know, but I thought this might come in our conversation, but it actually hasn't until now, which is there are a lot of things that you talk about that may be based in knowing, but for somebody like me and for many other people, they would need a lot more, backing up. They need supporting statements and evidence and all the rest of it, because they are items of faith, generally.
Yeah, as I said at the beginning, don't believe a word I'm saying. I'm only sharing what's my own experience, and I'm not asking anybody to believe anything. You know, absolutely not. Because that's where sheep thinking comes in, and I wouldn't want to encourage sheeple thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think you're in danger of becoming a dodgy guru or anything.
God.
No, I mean, you don't have that that kind of false authoritative voice that is trying to convince people of things. So, yeah.
No, I'm not convincing. Yeah, leave nothing. But anyway, right. Well, I'm getting tired now. It's midnight here.
Is it? It's 5. It's 10 past midnight. We've been on an hour and 55 minutes. Okay. So it's no longer Easter.
No. We never talked about Christ.
Well, for you, for me, it is Easter. We did talk about Christ. We most certainly did talk about... We talked about how we weren't talking about Christ, for one thing, but we also talked about Christ somewhat, a little bit.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting that... yes, Christ is quite hot on the block now.
Is he hot on the block? I think that'll be the title of the podcast. What's that mean, and how is that?
Well,
so
Well, in a few years ago, it was Christ was just only thought of as the bloke in the Bible, wasn't he? He was just you wouldn't think about him once.
I don't know about that. I mean, there's been the Gnostic Christ, and that and the whole Gnostic thing's been going for quite a long time. Because I mean, I was totally into it.
Yes, I do like the Gnostics, hence Sophia.
Right. So, but how do you mean that now he's kind of more hip? Is that what you mean?
Well, I think the Christ power is sufficiently, don't know, rising is the right word, or sufficiently here for people to have felt something and seen that it's not just to do with Jesus, seen that it's actual a reality. That's
Yeah.
Christ consciousness. And with all the changes happening and things hotting up, there's also a kind of calling to look inward and discover that inside. But I'm tired now.
Well, yeah, I don't, yeah, maybe. I mean, there's. I guess it depends who one's talking to.
I'll tell you one thing, yes, before I be quiet. When I went to Greece, I realised I did have assumptions that I would actually get on with people there. And the woman I went with, I hadn't got a thing in common with her, really. And I'd sort of assumed that people would be open to certain things, and they weren't. And then when I saw the complete corruption and lack of truth going right through everything, it was just seeing through the human condition, really, that there's absolutely no way on earth anything can be built out of any structure of belief which is already here, because it's rotten. It's completely rotten to the core. There were the aid agencies themselves. There was like power and corruption issues with them. There was power and corruption issues with the people traffickers, corruption with the smugglers, and there was the gypsies stealing from the refugees. Then there were the aid agencies who were bartering with cash which they'd raised, everywhere. It was just completely, even the people who were helping, it was sneaky, sneaky, dodgy goings on all the way through. And so once I sort of, that was my naivety. My naivety was, or rather gullibility, was thinking that somehow the aid agencies were kind of, I don't know, weren't as corrupt as other agencies was. It was corruption all the way through. So once I saw that and thought, well, actually, everywhere is corrupt, it's kind of, it's just what it is until it's not.
Kind of liberating, isn't it, seeing that?
Yes, I think it was. It was like completely seeing through the last wishful ideals that it was somehow okay, but it wasn't. None of it is. It's completely rotten to the core.
Yeah, I could have told you that.
See, that was my optimistic. But then behind that was this, the birds and the trees and nature and light. The truth of that was shining through it. So
Yeah. Like you
the
said,
rotten matrix was there in all its glory, but the greater power was shining through it.
yeah. Yeah, like you said, it's just a superficial level.
It was really was obvious that this dimension is really is wafer thin. Yet we put so much, we believe it to be deep and solid, but it's not. It's flimsy.
Like the shell of an egg, maybe.
It's not even that thick. It's like, it's like gossamer.
Well, I thought that was a good Easter note to
Oh,
end
and the
on.
egg. Okay. Very profound. Yes.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when this world come tumbling.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your prayer. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his world came tumbling. His mind. Oh, here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Oh, here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La fille dans la jungle sec. Ça prépare.